A sect presents itself as the embodiment of the socialist movement, though it is a membership organization whose boundary is set up more or less rigidly by the points in its political program rather than by its relation to the social struggle. In contrast, a working-class party is not simply an electoral organization, but rather, whether electorally engaged or not, an organization which really is the political arm of decisive sectors of the working class, which politically reflects or refracts the working class in motion as it is. A socialist movement sums up the mass manifestations of a socialist working class in various fields, not only the political, usually around the mass socialist party. For present purposes, the important distinction is between the sect form of organization and a form of organization common in other countries, but which does not yet exist in this backward country. Hello, and welcome to the Regrettable Century. I'm Chris.
I'm Kevin.
I'm Jason.
And I'm Jenny.
And today we are talking about the death of the microsect.
Finally.
Yes, and that might be something we could all be happy about, except for that we don't really have anything of any value to replace it with.
The birth of the macrosect. Let's go.
Oh, if only.
In the past couple of weeks, I'd say about a month, we've seen the long overdue implosion of our former organization, the ISO. And it's actually been pretty tragic to watch, not because it's not something that needed to happen, because I absolutely think that the time of the ISO and all other microsect organizations has long been over, but just in the nature of that collapse, which, you know, I mean, that's been talked about ad nauseum elsewhere, so we won't have to get into that too much.
Well, I think the what's so negative about it is that it didn't have to end that way, right?
Right.
It could have sort of rolled into something better rather than just dying, not with a bang, but with a whimper.
Yeah. I mean, I think that in one of the articles that we read, it said that there was a moment that the ISO could have used to open up the organization to more transparency and more democracy and sort of inoculate against the inevitable sect death that was bound to occur and is also occurring in so many other organizations at the same time, that the ISO completely just ignored and sort of doubled down on their undemocratic and sectarian practices. And that would have been after the sort of implosion of the British SWP. Since then, I think the thing that, to me, really underscores the uselessness of the ISO in its final years is its relation to the new popularity of socialism that accompanied the Bernie Sanders moment in 2016 and since then, and the way that the ISO and, you know, the SEP, the Workers' World Party, all the other Leninist sect organizations or, you know, Trotskyist and Marxist-Leninist sect organizations sort of related to that moment was to loudly shout about how Sanders isn't really a socialist.
Yeah, imagine being like, Green Day isn't punk. This is real punk. And in like 1994 and expecting anyone who liked Green Day to give a shit. It's like that.
Yeah, I was totally one of those people. Not 1994, because, like, I'm not that old, but I'm only barely not that old.
Also not that old. I was just guessing, because I don't think I knew who Green Day was yet either.
The crack-up of the ISO is a perfect kind of, like, touchstone, or let's say a bellwether or whatever. It's a perfect reason. It's a great reason to be talking about the concept of the microsect, because it's the left that we all grew up in. It's the left that most people mm-hmm. in this country know, going back a very long time. We get to talk to somebody who's fairly advanced in age, who was fairly young, you know, in the 1960s, to even begin to talk about what it looked like to have, like, something resembling a large scale form of organization on the left. And even then, it's still like the microsect system that we have is kind of all born out of that. The breakup of the ISO is a good reason to talk about it, but I think there's a lot of ways in which we we can get it wrong very easily because the nature of the breakup of the ISO, I think, is somewhat obscured. People know the story about some, you know, pretty horrible scandals and abuses of leadership, whatever. But I think the Socialism One Organization article is a really great starting point for analyzing the context in which such things can happen at all, which is like a model of organization built around like rigid adherence to like the idea, right? So that you construct the idea, the ideal version of what will happen, recruit people to that thing, and then discipline them by their relative level of agreement to that conception. So like when Draper talks about the organization with a special viewpoint as its organizational boundary, as a sect, and he counterposes that to like in the Communist Manifesto or in the writings of Karl Marx and the actions of Marx and Engels of seeking merely to be organizing at the advance guard of the movement as a whole. I think that, the contrast between those two things is not very clear without a lot of digging in. Because I think we've always said, oh, that's what we're trying to be, right? But clearly that's not what our own experiences have sort of showed us to have done.
Yeah. So I think that you've said this previously, Jason, that that I think every single last one of these sects, rather than seeing themselves as the nucleus of the vanguard party, sees themselves as a cadre organization that will dissolve itself into the party when party building time begins. And I think that with
I'm not sure that transition has ever really been thought through in any legitimate sense before, though, because, it's been often, I've heard it often formulated as, we're not the Revolutionary Party. We're not even the seed of the Revolutionary Party. We hope to build ourselves to the point where we can play a part in the construction of the Revolutionary Party. But that would necessitate going from being like, directing what you see as a sort of micro kernel of cadre to dissolving yourself into a bigger organization where you aren't, you don't get to dictate the terms of anything. That transition, I don't think makes any sense or has ever been, or was ever, like, concretely thought through.
Honestly, I don't think that it was a claim that was made in good faith. I don't think that any of these organizations ever thought that they would be around long enough to have to like deal with it. And they were all groups that came up out of the New Left and organized themselves along the lines of the New Communist Movement as it emerged out of the New Left. And every single last one of those groups organized themselves around a sort of like theological understanding of their Marxism, It's like a very dogmatic, very intellectually rigorous, however intellectually rigorous you can be as like a fucking MLM or just like frothing at the mouth, regurgitating Trotskyists, I think that they only ever thought that they were going to have to just perpetuate their organization. And they all did a pretty decent job of that.
Yeah, all the way up until they didn't. That's another one of the things that Draper takes on early on in the Anatomy of the Microsect article, which really ought to be just foundational reading for every socialist at this point, I feel like. Because
absolutely.
He makes the point, I think, quite convincingly that there's literally never been a single case of a perfectly worked out or relatively worked out coherent theoretical grounding of a sect, of like a build a cadre, which then exponentially becomes a greater and greater from micro to macro sect to mass party to whatever. And in fact, he even makes, he points out that like even the unification of various smaller sects into a bigger one has only ever created an unstable sect. Right.
Mm-hmm.
What I thought was fascinating was in that New Communist Movement article that the author, whose name escapes me at the moment, they said that the Bolsheviks actually led the revolution without a Leninist party.
That's true. They did.
So the process of premature sect building is an arresting has an arresting effect on the development of a working class party and their example. And I think refreshingly compared to the way that I've, you know, been taught to reference 1917, their example was 1917 and about how, like, all the way up until the actual seizure of power, like within just a few years before all of that, there was never even so much as a clarified Bolshevik faction in the way that we understand a faction, but merely just like groupings of people within a large, relatively, I don't know, I guess I want to say chaotic, but like, you know, like the Social Democratic Party was groups of workers organized into circles, agitating at their workplaces and then reading socialist theory. And then they all express kind of fealty to the idea of this party. And then you fast forward long enough, and at some point they're like, no more factions, which is like really bizarre to consider when you think about their whole process of existence up to that point, where every single different local set of party members, you know, had different ideas based on their own organizing conditions.
I like the example he used in that article of Trotsky having been one of Lenin's chief political opponents in Russia for the past decade, like one of his most vocal political opponents, joins the Bolsheviks with his whole, you know, left Menshevik faction, and is immediately on the Central Committee of Communist Party. And he likens that to, imagine, you know, one of the ML organizations in the United States allowing a group of Trotskyists to join it and then immediately giving them like a large proportional representation on their steering committee, you know, which like
I can't imagine it actually.
Yeah, it wouldn't happen. Like, but he talks about how what he refers to as the classical Leninist party, as it is understood in the United States, is a fetishization of, you know, Civil War era, like war communist, fending off 14 invading armies, like fighting a death struggle and in the middle of a famine, Leninism, and which, unfortunately, the Bolshevik Party kind of was stuck in from that point forward to a greater or lesser extent.
I thought you were going to say, unfortunately, that's just not where we are.
Yeah, the valor, shit, the taking of measures of necessity being transmogrified into values unto themselves, the things that became true because they had to be true, reluctantly so, for a time, then were like turned into the things that we say this is desirable and the way it ought to be, and we should organize ourselves along these lines. The point, though, that I thought was incredibly useful was the failed harvest piece that put forward what read to me as a very constructive materialist analysis of the economy of the microsect that looked at what made this mode of organizing successful for the time that it operated in and what made it suddenly no longer successful and hence thrust into crisis.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that makes a lot of sense to me that, you know, this mode of organizing became old habit and hard to change, but not impossible to change. And the individuals in the leadership of these organizations should be held to blame for their refusal to change in change conditions. But one can still recognize the sort of the surrounding realities that they were operating in that gave rise to it. I think if I remember correctly, the way they laid it out was to say that there was a time in which there were a few mildly successful sects in the United States, at least, that represented the whole and entirety of what is socialism. And they had the ability of constructing high demand organizations that put high demands on membership and and said, if you step out of bounds of what we regard as permissible membership in our organization, we will we have the threat of kicking you out, and we have the stick of being able to excommunicate you. We have the carrot of being able to offer you advancement into leadership positions, speaking positions, even getting published, and maybe even maybe if you stick around long enough, maybe even get paid to get published. That no longer held, that that kick and that stick and that carrot no longer makes any sense in a world where socialism actually exists outside of a couple of tiny sects, a couple of tiny organizations that, you know, they don't have a monopoly on the market anymore. There's now a huge and vastly larger, more influential and important thing in the world surrounding everybody, so that when you know, this organization says we're going to kick you out if you don't fall in line, the response is, okay, and yeah, that's a step up for me.
Right.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think that there are probably more socialists that are not in organizations in the United States right now than there are socialists in organizations. And probably the best socialists that are out there are probably not in organizations. I mean, it, as far as, like, people that I'm reading anyway, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think to be generous first to the last generation, the one which is the one that, you know, gave us all of our initial ideas and experiences, probably there wasn't very much that could have been done for most right. of that period. And when I say that period, I mean like the post 60s and 70s, like after the long 60s, after the Vietnam War, at the beginning of the onset of neoliberalism, you know, Reagan and the collapse and all of the stuff, right? The 80s and 90s and so on. It was really probably very difficult. And, you know, they were the inheritors of some other traditions that were not so good, and they did the best that they could probably for a while. But that doesn't in any way, I think, remove the necessity of the damning indictment that is the refusal to try to do something different. I was in the ISO and learned all sorts of bad habits, and I left right about the time that the Socialism in One Organization article refers to as, like, things finally opened up. The reason why is because I felt myself, like, making the argument that things are opening up and we can change and we can become a different kind of organization, a different kind of movement, and finding that to be unwelcome, you know.
That was right around the time, just to put things into context for listeners, that Kashama Sawant was elected to Seattle City Council, and there was a lot of talk about organizing electorally in Chicago, and none of that organization included the ISO, because the ISO was very hostile to getting involved in electoral politics and in places where it was actually reaping benefits.
Yeah,
and frankly, it wasn't very useful. So, like, the people who were interested in running electoral campaigns didn't see the ISO as an asset. They weren't, like, looking at these people and being like, "Oh, wow, you've been aloof from anything existing in the entirety of the world except college campuses for however many decades. You're super valuable to have on our campaign." Yeah, like, you know, like, nobody's looking to these self-declared cadre and movement leaders for their leadership abilities. Like, what use do you bring to the table, you know?
I left the ISO probably about a year before you did, Jason. And the reason I did was because I witnessed a convention season in which the ISO did a very cynical about-face on questions of identity politics. Without very much discussion at all, they just sort of rewrote the book on how they were going to approach identity politics, and it very much seemed like, we're doing this in order to stay relevant, without any sort of embracing of the actual spirit behind what motivates people to get get involved with identity-based politics. You know, I mean, the Women in Socialism book was rewritten to, like, sort of get rid of the fact that the ISO had eschewed adopting the term feminism for the entirety of its existence. And I was just like, this doesn't seem like really the way to relate to people. This is sort of just like changing the curtains so that, like, the structure looks better, when in reality the entire structure is functioning just the same. It wasn't an opening up. It wasn't a reorientation to better address the concerns of people of color and women and whatnot. It was just sort of like, oh, we'd better, you know, stop offending people by saying that we're not feminists. You know what I mean?
So a couple of things. And I hate that so much of our conversations, and especially this one, are framed by our own experiences in the ISO, especially since we had this conversation planned before the dissolution of the organization. But, you know, I think that's the thing about sect organizing is that, you know, or at least in part, right, is that it leads to really lazy theorizing. I don't think there's any under theorizing within most of these sects, and the ISO is certainly not the only sect guilty of this, and not even the most guilty, which is important to remember. You know, that's just our experience, and I guess perhaps what we're most qualified to talk on. So there's a lot of lazy theorizing because, you know, all of these sects are organized around ideas and not actual practices, because the only practices really are propagandizing and, you know, like selling newspapers for the most part. So, you know, a lot of these sects were, like, all of them, if not, were completely unprepared to have a real conversation about socialism and, like, electoral politics. It felt like either people were too convinced that, like, revolutionary politics were going to, like, somehow become popular very suddenly, or that, like, this day would never come. And I don't think any of the conversations had about, like, reform or revolution prepared most people within these organizations to tackle, like, the Bernie moment or any of those ones that came after it, right? And I think the same thing can be said about, you know, identity politics, which is that we had these, like, very mechanical and well-rehearsed conversations and talking points about privilege theory and identity politics that didn't leave room for people to actually, like, think for themselves about developing a true analysis of oppression and how to fight it. You know, I think all we have are these, like, historical lessons to draw upon and no understanding of, like, what those mean in these particular moments in a completely new millennia in which we have to grapple with these really hard questions. And that's hard and really painful for a lot of people to come to terms with, but it's also true.
Painful is right. Like, because, you know, the alternative to the microsect existence that has gone on offer at the present moment, right, is the Democratic Socialists of America, which is, let's say it carries its own problems. And the problem is not people who And the problem is not that people, you know, want reform instead of revolution, which is really, like, a bad way of remembering the goddamn thesis of that book.
Yeah, seriously.
Sure.
Right. And I don't
1,000%.
I don't think that that's a criticism made in good faith of the DSA either.
Nah, right. It's neither an understanding of Luxembourg or the DSA. And in fact, I would even say it is insufficiently dialectical. But the problem with the DSA is maybe it's the problem of anything that's brand new and is rooted in nothing and is chaotic. And this is thus going to be very painful as people try to figure it all out.
Tyranny of structurallessness. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been compared to Occupy, but more explicitly socialist. And I think that's apt, because Occupy was, in the end, an absolute fucking disaster by nature of the fact that it was structureless. It didn't have clear goals. and anyone can be a part of it. Wreckers, opportunists, you know, everyone.
Any and everybody. Yeah. I am not of the mentality that you should be in the DSA if you want to be a socialist. I actually was for a while. The position I'm coming to, I think, looks more like everything is in flux. Everything's going to be chaos. And from one location to the next, and even from one moment to the next, the spaces and opportunities for people as individuals to make contributions and as groups to kind of recompose and to, you know, scatter and reconvene, they're all going to look very different. And like, to say that, oh, the moment is open and it's time to join the big open group, to me is still, I think it might still be the microsect mentality, but just, you know, extrapolated, you know, to Jenny, the way that you put it, the macrosect, which is to say that we haven't really yet learned to like, internalize, or let's say we haven't yet really fully come to appreciate the maxim that one step of real movement is worth a thousand programs, which is to say that, like, you know, the working class in motion, regardless of what it is we say about it, is going to be the only thing that gives us any hint of a chance of reviving like a socialist movement. And whatever ideas we've got about it, that's all incidental until then. Even yeah.
How many people are there in the United States?
A bunch.
Like 50?
Several.
At least.
Several. I'll look it up. I got
326.
Okay,
so there are 326 million people in the United States and about 50,000 people in the DSA. The DSA isn't much better than a microsect, you know? I mean, like, proportionally, there's not a whole hell of a lot of difference between the tiny little microsects that existed before the DSA and the DSA now. The only difference is that it's got a much higher profile, and there are more and more and more and more people talking about socialism as a result of the fact that the DSA exists. So the DSA may have its primary value in putting red flags up everywhere for people to see and talk about socialism. I have always said this, and I still say this, that like, the best thing that will come out of the DSA won't be, you know, the Labor Party that creates social democracy in the United States. And it won't be the, you know, the Revolutionary Party. It'll just be the connections that we make with people that are worth organizing with in the future. And that's it.
The friends we make along the way.
The real DSA is the friends we make along the way.
The friends in low places. So very I think that's person. Kind of not to like be everyone's mom all the time, but also to be everyone's mom all the time. I think that kind of helps us draw from, you know, other negative behaviors that like microsects engage in, which is like not just viewing everything as an opportunity to like dunk on the other sex, which like I don't want this to be or become, because I think we're all like actually trying to figure this shit out. But also, which is to say that like it's prevented us from learning like real lessons and hearing people out and listening to other people, because we get hung up on like vocabulary and traditions. And I'm not saying that those things don't mean anything, right? But it is to say that like when the DSA first saw their rise to prominence, it was like, okay, cool, let's have all these conversations about Harrington, which like actually don't mean anything to most people right now. And it meant that we weren't actually like learning or living. Man, I hate saying living in the moment. That sounds corny, but I don't know how else to put that. Yeah, and I think the same thing can be said of, you know, a number of other, maybe not sects, but like organizations and networks that have been doing good work.
That was one of the criticisms of the sect mentality that I saw in, I think it was the New Communist Movement an Obituary article that we read, was that that within the sect mentality, it makes it impossible to acknowledge that anyone else could be doing good work.
Yeah.
And that is absolutely true from my involvement with people that were part of Frizzo and PSL and CWI and everyone else, is that regardless of the work that is being done in movements or wherever else, like regardless of how good it is, it's almost impossible to get like a word of praise in from someone else.
Yeah, they're all just a competing organization.
Right. And the World Socialist website almost exists. It exists for like the sole purpose of just castigating other organizations on the left that aren't as good as it is, you know? So like, I think that there are like 11 people involved in that whole project, and it is their job to just like fucking shit talk the entire rest of the left.
One of the things that struck me when, you know, and I forget which Draper article now, I think it's the Toward a New Beginning. He makes a reference to the fact that Marx and Engels both like desperately desire the demise of the, you know, Marxist group in the United States, because of how bizarrely it sort of like set itself up to be like, we're a Marxist group. And, you know, unfortunately it survived into the 70s. And
I think it's still around technically.
Well,
it's like
technically.
Three people in it, but I think it's still there.
Yeah, it's the Socialist Labor Party. And it was founded as the Working Men's Party or whatever. And like, if you go back and read like Engels' correspondence with German emigres living in the United States, one of the things that the sort of the constant thread is, he's like, you people, you have to figure out a way out of this bizarre situation that you're in, where you like have constituted this political group apart from the working class that has decided what the working class must do, and then it goes around saying it like, if the workers would only do this, then X, right? So it's interesting to think
it's
that,
like the SPART formula.
Yeah, it's the SPART formula. It's the microsect formula. And so all the way back to, you know, let's say day one, that has been the wrong way to do it, according to the, you know, the people we all pretend to worship. And so, like, even the best groups, whatever.
According to the big beards.
According to the big beards, that's the wrong way to do it. No, and you can contrast that.
You get
too.
Diminishing return with facial hair.
Yeah, you can.
Lack of facial hair equals lack of
Jesus Christ,
theoretical
man.
Purity.
That's true. Actually, there's a
well.
There's apparently it was a common joke in China at one point to refer to like any government building as a hall of shaving, because you would have Marx with his crazy unkempt beard, and then Engels with a really groomed one, and then Lenin with the Fu Manchu, and then Mao completely clean shaven.
Or Stalin with just the mustache.
Oh, I forgot about Stalin. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyways, none of that was about...
We often do.
None of that was supposed to be about Marx and beards even. But it's to say that, you know, the creation of the actual first like mass workers' party in this country is the Socialist Party. Their origins are... You know, their origins were very different. It was just various kind of class groups merging until they had a party. And they had like wildly different ideas about what building a, you know, what it meant to arrive at the socialist horizon. And, you know, the way that I learned that was that that was their fundamental flaw, was that it was a mashup of different ideas. But it's also the only time that socialism was a mass phenomenon. You know, it was from the Socialist Party until it's a, you know, until McCarthyism, right? With all the communists come out of it. Fuck, I'm just thinking out loud. I don't know where I'm going with any of this.
That's our podcast. Welcome to our podcast, Thinking Out Loud.
thinking out loud at the world.
I think that's that train of
at
thought.
And with one another.
I think what I'll in the notes, I'll probably find that train of thought actually ended at the jokes about beards. And that's fine. Because
yeah, whenever I derailed you.
Well, yeah, it's okay. It was too long of a thought.
I mean, was it? I mean, the masses make the movement. The organizations and parties do not, which is why like no one organization has control or a hold on the direction of what, like, this, whatever this moment is, ends up looking like. Which is not to say that, like, you know, no one has an impact. Just, like...
No one has an impact.
So, I really appreciated when Hal Draper was talking about, what... The sect has never mattered, has never done anything productive. It's only ever sort of funneled people into tiny little groupings that go nowhere. Was talking about how what has worked in the past and what has mattered in the world has been socialists getting involved with actually existing movements outside of their tiny little groupings of, you know, intellectuals or whatever else, and organizing with those movements and thinking with those movements and sort of cohering cadre out of that, and helping to sort of like organize it in a productive direction. 'Cause I felt like my road out of a sect was exactly that sort of a frustration of just being tired with waving a sign around at protests and sitting in reading groups, especially reading groups, reading the you know, going back to the same fucking...
Building the Party.
Yeah, exactly. This
100 times.
The same fucking books over and over and over again. Like, I've read this. I get it.
Okay, but what is to be done?
Well, yeah. What is to be done? And so, you know, I ultimately left because I just couldn't tolerate... I didn't have a better idea of what the fuck else to do, but I just didn't have any... I found it to be utterly useless to be banging my head against the same wall over and over again in an organization that I used to think could, this is, you know, maybe it's imperfect, but it could be reformed and be brought and opened up and made more democratic. And you know, different ideas could be entertained and maybe we could start to do things that are a little bit more productive, but I'm just tired of being in this organization. It doesn't seem like it's going to happen. And I had nowhere else to go, but it was when, in that moment when the world changed outside of that organization that I really started, I had like a glimmer of hope in myself.
Wait,
I walked out of my last ISO meeting into the clean and open air and I said, yeah, but fucking Cuba is tight though. And I was free.
So like, Kevin, whenever you said, you know, you said that you didn't know what else to do, but you just knew you didn't want to do this anymore.
Yeah.
Like, one of the things that Draper references is the fact that the Communist League, you know, which was founded for the purpose of agitation of communist ideas among working men or whatever, dissolves itself into the movement, into the 1848 revolution. And then in the wake of the defeat or the receding of that whole movement, Communist League reconstructs itself for a moment, and then it kind of dissolves very quickly when they realize we don't have an audience, no one gives a shit right now. And then Marx and Engels spend the next like 20 years just in the library. You know, what they didn't do is try to hold down the Communist League and codify practices and ideas, you know, about how to build until the upsurge came and lifted them back up, right? Like,
right, yeah, and collect dues to pay their own wages to sustain themselves, right?
Right.
Like, I mean, that we have to. I think you have to get very literal about the economics of the sect, which is that there is a very small group of people who have been doing this for a very long time and have no other job skills or resume to speak of. And they have to perpetuate their own, you know, they have to reproduce themselves in a capitalist economy.
Yeah.
So around the time that I decided to leave the ISO, we could not touch our water in my city. Not like we couldn't drink our water. We couldn't touch our water for days. And they fixed all of the white people's and, you know, like more middle class and upper middle class areas of the city within a few days, and everywhere else took longer, right? And there were two things that became like very clear to me I hadn't given enough thought to because of the way I was trained in the ISO. One of those was that like I did not have enough familiarity with the single person who sat on our city council or with what they did at all. That's bad socialism. And this is a call out. If like you do not know who sits on your city council and you don't know what it is they have control over in the particular place that you live, like you're doing it wrong, right? Because we needed to know who to blame. One, the industry, right, who like dumped an emulsifying agent into our water supply and then was largely held unaccountable for it at all. But then two, the people in charge of like damage control who like did a bad job and of course like are, you know, in bed with these industries in this city, right? The other thing that became really clear is that we had to get water to people who had no way of accessing water, who could not come to distribution stations, and there were not enough of them, and most of them were organized by the community and not the city, right? And that sort of activity was stuff we never engaged in within the organization, but we had to, you know, and not because we were not part of those communities that had no access to water, you know, but because like we lived in those communities and those people were, you know, our families, our friends, right? And, you know, it just became so clear to me that we hadn't, you know, though like we exist in the world and in our workspaces or whatever, and we argue for our positions, like we hadn't actually, you know, in my view, been doing
any socialism.
We hadn't been doing any socialism. It's true. We had been doing like lazy and like very underdeveloped, like substitutionism. Mm-hmm. And
Synchronized shouting, essentially.
Yeah, and like I'm making not saying, signs
and yelling. That's what we did.
Sure, and I'm not saying that there isn't work that I did within the ISO that I'm not proud of. I'm not saying that there aren't conversations and struggles I engaged in during my time in the ISO that I didn't learn from and that didn't prepare me for like where I'm at now. But I am saying, like, that was such an eye-opening experience to me because, you know, it really made me understand, like, we have to have some, like, fight some winnable fights, you know? Like, our lives are shitty. you know, our communities are shitty and we're not doing enough to, like, make the places we actually live better. And that's not to say we don't continue to, like, flesh out our views on imperialism or any of the like really big, more difficult questions. But it is to say like there are things we can do in the meantime that help us win more people over to the work we're doing and also like ameliorate suffering that is incredibly real.
It's almost like you're saying that the organizing for the reforms is the basis that makes revolutionary action possible.
Well, yeah, like, so I'm always of two minds about this, because on the one hand, I think it's right to say, like, I think it's conditioned by the fact that, you know, for a long time we operated in a space where there was a limited amount of what was possible. So in the first instance, it's right to say that life inside of one of the healthier microsects, for a while was a good training ground for a couple of basic things about inculcating a sense that like you can act in the world and you can your life can matter, and you know, you can throw yourself into the project of liberating humanity, and that actually might mean sometimes something very concrete and tangible, like being involved in the campaign to save the life of Kenneth Foster. That's tangible, right?
That's true, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Just to pick one example of many, and other people have different examples of, you know, they got their introduction to, you know, I got my introduction to trade union politics from the ISO. I was brought to my first picket line by that. Some people I know became very important, like, organizers in a very real sense. And I don't mean, like, necessarily always paid staff of a union, but, like, organizers in the sense that they could, in their workplace, could act as part of the nucleus of shop floor level organization, where workers actualized, you know, their own themselves in opposition to the boss. And, you know, that was, for a lot of us, that was, we got our introduction to everything in the ISO. And the same thing when it comes to, you know, politics, to philosophy, to Marxism. But then the limitations of all that are also very much on display, especially as the world around us has changed, because ultimately everything's determined by our conditions. And I feel like in the last 5 years, 4 years, much of what I've been able, what I've had to do is basically unlearn everything I learned in my training, in my boot camp that was being in the microsite. So it's not necessarily the case that it was like, well, this is what we could do, so we did it then, and it prepared us for something better, because in a lot of ways it produced, even in all of us, like a very maladjusted conception of what an organizer is, what an organization is, and what a movement is. And I don't think we fully, that's, you know, when we talked about theory and the over-theorization or under-theorization, I think that's under-theorized right now.
I'm correcting hard against that now by reading lots of Walter Benjamin and becoming a navel-gazing romanticist.
Yeah, I'm here for that.
Hell yeah. And actually, no, go ahead.
Well, it's just like anything else that involves conditioning, right? Is that, like, a lot of times you achieve the desired effect, but also you have to consider at what expense.
Yeah.
Right? And I think it's true that I will speak for myself and let other people speak their truth, that, like, that produced some real trauma within me, and I would assume probably other comrades. So yeah, you know, it's a mixed bag for sure.
In the McNally period party and the next left, he gives the way he puts it, he's urging a sharp break from the microsect priorities or practices. Sorry, urging a sharp break from the microsect practices, and he outlines three sort of defining features of the microsect mentality that I think are pretty useful. And the first one is that there's the notion that there is no revolution without a party, that, like, the organization makes the fundamental social transformation, you know, that otherwise without the party, that a social upheaval is only that, but that social transformation, that revolution itself requires the vehicle. The second one is that our group is the carry, whoever the group you are, right? Carries forward the tradition of the party, whichever revolution, mm-hmm. right? And the third one is, logically flows from the first two, that there can't be a revolution without us, but us squared, right? A larger, more encompassing version of our group as the inheritor of the tradition.
Yeah, so the way that I understood our importance as a sect was that we were the collective memory of the working class. We're there to like, you know, carry the torch. And it was up to us to carry that torch because everyone else had it wrong.
Yeah, and we were waiting for the day until everyone just sort of like woke up and realized how right we were. And we had mass influence suddenly. But I think Draper really hit the nail on the head whenever he talked about, like, there's a... God, what was the term he used? It was like natural scale when he was talking about natural boundaries that acted as a barrier to just scaling something down, pretending like you're still you're operating in the world as if you're a party, despite being a tiny, tiny, tiny little microsect. And he uses the metaphor of talking about like an ant can carry 50 times its weight, and that is a particular feature of its being really, really tiny. And if you had the exact same animal and just blew it up into a bigger size, it would not be able to carry 50 times its weight. Similarly, you can't just scale a sect into a party and then until it gets to the size of a big mass party and then it operates in the same way. It is a qualitatively different thing in the world between something that has a mass base and something that operates in the world as a tiny, irrelevant little self-perpetuating sect.
Well, yeah, substitutionism is a fucking hell of a drug. there is something about the way, you know, we fetishize, or not me, but other people fetishize, like, this disciplined party or organization or organizers is, like, a prerequisite for revolution, like, the revolutionary process as a whole, which draws incomplete lessons from the way we understand or misunderstand Bolshevism to have developed to begin with. And I think leads us to this like very strange place of failing to understand the people that we're struggling with and the people we're struggling against.
I think it opens up an interesting question, though. It's helps us, I think, begin to conceive of a broader, let's say a deeper understanding of the problem of the political form, which is that, like, talking about the sectarian existence, the phenomenon of the sectarian existence is easier, I think, when we're talking about scale, like a tiny group that purports to be representative of the real Marxist tradition, as we used to say.
Oh.
That's fairly easy for us to get our heads around. I think what's more difficult is to get our heads around a much more complex problem, which is one of scope. Because, you know, certain moments in history might be very favorable in certain instances to a large audience for a sect, but that the sect is still a sect by virtue of how it conceives of itself and conducts itself. If there's no revolution without a party, our group equals the tradition, and that means there's no revolution without us. For a moment, under a certain amount of duress or whatever, you might be able to cobble together a fairly large grouping on that basis, but it's still fundamentally a sectarian existence. And the long-term ramifications of that are, well, what they are is they're still substitutionist, in that they're still that the sect, the organization, whatever, that political form is still arrayed against the broader class as a whole. And if the point of all of this is the self-emancipation of the working class, then small or large, if your political form actually requires you to exist, in no matter what the circumstances, then actually it might be arrayed against the working class itself. And that's much harder to get around, because like that sectarian mentality can exist at the macro level. And it still doesn't seem like it gets us where we need to go. In fact, we aren't where we needed to go.
We didn't get there.
The whole basis of like the reason why we decided to like get together and talk about these things as a group and record it is because this century seems pretty regrettable, but the last one did too.
Yeah. And the last one, being as regrettable as it was, has directly informed how regrettable this one is. And it is a direct result of our failures. Not mine and yours personally. Too much smaller.
You've let us down. Maybe. You've let the class down. You have let yourselves down.
So Draper, you know, contrasts the sect form to what he calls the political center. And I wonder if that's worth trying to dig into a little bit. Because...
Yes, please.
Let's... So, okay, like, when he talks about a political center, his... The sort of outline of the formation of the political center was, you know, a grouping of people, you know, in a given kind of, like, area of, like, work or whatever, that kind of get together and deal with things politically and then produce literature about it and try to, like, bring people into it. And he contrasts that to the people who formulate a program and then recruit people to the program. And so the idea is that the political center is an organic growth out of the class movement rather than a grafting on to the class movement or an attempt to do so. And I like the way that he talks about it. He illustrates different kinds of political centers because it's a methodology. It doesn't have an inherent ideological content. So he refers to like Stalinist political centers and liberal political centers. And in the era of print media, you know, that a print organ that kind of like acts as a sort of clearinghouse for those activities to broadcast the conclusions or the debates or whatever of that core in a given center. That's the embodiment of the political center. You know, and he refers to Iskra, the actual lesson of what is to be done about the newspapers, the scaffolding or whatever. And the way that we learned that was like, we have an organization, so people need to read our newspaper so they'll join our organization. But the actual argument was, all the workers in this factory and all the workers in that factory and whatever, like, you know, they're having these arguments and we should print that shit so other workers in other factories can read it. And then we're all going to be a part of some, you know, we're all part of this broader thing. So we contrast the political center to the sect, no matter which terms you want to use, because what we're really talking about is a methodology. What's less clear to me is in the era post-print media, because like, I think at this point we have to acknowledge that's just not, I don't remember the last time that I picked up a newspaper.
When's the last time you did a paper sale?
But 2014.
Not long terrible enough experience. Ago.
So again, so I'm just thinking out loud here, and I'm working towards something, I guess, which is to say, like, I don't think the conclusion that I would want to accidentally lead toward is if you want to find good socialist praxis in the 21st century in 2019 in the United States, that what you ought to do is like start a blog, because
please don't even,
because I still think that or a podcast. So like, I want to be really clear that I don't think that's what we're doing, and I don't think that's what we should be trying to do with this, right? Like, or any similar such project, because the political center in the way that Draper talks about it, it's an expression of a collaboration between people in a given kind of work, in a given project.
I think Jacobin Magazine would be a very good example of a political center that really gave voice to a range of Marxist theorists without setting forward a hard line on anything, but it also acted as a pole of attraction to a particular organization that built that organization and also built that section of that organization that put forward a particular kind of political vision of what should be, how that organization should operate and how do we change the world and engage with it.
Yeah. And I think some would be hesitant to use Jacobin as an example, but because of how like uneven it has been in terms of like quality and stuff like that. But, you know, I'd also just like argue that that is a reflection of the size and like scope of its writers and readership, right? I think that one of the things we read said something about like the need to develop like new vocabulary and bridge different traditions. And I would add to that, like, one's yet to be defined, right? And I think that process is going to be a kind of messy and necessary one, because we can't keep relying on this like really futile adherence to whether or not we're being good, this, that, or whatever, right? Which is not to say those words don't have any meaning, but like we can't be so obsessed with like thinking about what would Marx do or who pick your other like dead person that it's preventing us from actually like understanding the moment we're in, and also that like we recognize that Marx was wrong about a number of things, right? I just don't actually think I'm not of the opinion that we're even using a Marxist method when we have a lot of these conversations about how to organize most effectively and how to bridge any of the work that we're doing on the left.
Yeah, I said it before, even in this podcast, that like the least interesting thing to me is whether or not someone is Trotskyist or Maoist or whatever, because like I really, it's not just because I find it dull, but actually because I find it harmful. Yeah. It's not just that it's not interesting, it's actually it's a problem. Mm-hmm. Because the whole concept of tradition should be, I think, thought of as anathema to what it means to be radical. And there's difference in theory and like, you know, trying to be intelligent about what it is we're doing. But when you talk about tradition, we talk about ideology, we're talking about something that's codified, something that has a checklist, like you said, pick your favorite, you know, dead old person or living person, right?
And true shit.
Right? And you know, make sure that you're adhering to some minimum agreed upon set of boxes on the checklist. Now, of course, I think we can veer into anti-intellectualism really quickly that way. People use words to describe phenomena. It's like terms exist, and that's fine. And, you know, I'm prepared to call myself socialist or communist or even Marxist, because I think that gives people at least a vague idea of what it is we're talking about. But beyond that, I think it gets very harmful when we say, well, what kind? What does it matter? I think everybody's wrong. So I don't want to be like any of that.
Yeah, I say this all the time. I just wanted to reiterate, post-Titoist. No, wait. Yeah, eco-post-Titoist. There we go. That's what I was trying
still
to say.
Still ironing it out. It's fresh and fun.
I take a lot of comfort in having been lambasted and criticized over the last year, depending on from whom it comes, as a Stalinist, as a Trotskyist, and as, like, whatever a situationist is. Like, those are quotes. So that dude's a Stalinist or whatever. And I think that's hitting upon something I think that's actually useful, which is like, it shouldn't be that easy to characterize.
To use right? words?
It shouldn't be that easy to characterize where somebody's coming from, that it's like, oh, that, you know, that's the, I found the box that they fit into. On the left, anyways.
Yeah, the left is in a high school cafeteria. Like,
I mean, Jason, I think I would agree with what you're saying, only insofar as the categories that we're operating with are steeped in material conditions that no longer obtain. It's not that having a, you know, like a school of thought that makes sense to you and you think is correct is bad and wrong, but rather that the schools, the demarcations that we use and have been using up to this point are just they're useless artifacts of a world that doesn't exist anymore. Like the idea of identifying your category of thinking with Leon Trotsky, who stopped writing a very fucking long time ago, doesn't make any fucking sense. It just doesn't make any sense. You can talk about, I think that the Russian Revolution was broadly a good thing. There were lots of mistakes that the Soviet Union made after that. That, you know, that makes sense. But saying, therefore, I am a Trotskyist doesn't make any fucking sense at all. All it says to me is that you're LARPing some historical reenactment society, and that's about the extent of what I'm gleaning from that.
So McNally, it says that we should reimagine the process of fusion and regroupment, and that we, like, you know, should be seeking to engage with the cultural revolution that's taking place on the left right now. And he makes a reference to the life-giving breeze of democracy, you know, in the revolutionary moment. Because, you know, McNally is an IS person, like where we come from. So his point of reference is 1917. And when he says that, he refers to the life-giving breeze of democracy. When everything is in flux and everything is up in the air and there's this upheaval and people's horizons are raised. And that energy comes into the movement, and that's really where it gets reshaped, and it's not actually about like this school of thought wins over that one or whatever. And that sounds nice, but then I think about Twitter and I wonder about the life-giving breeze of democracy. Because of course that's not really what he's referring to. He's not referring to giving everybody an equal platform or whatever. What he's talking about is democracy in the philosophical sense of engagement with the world, where human beings think of their role as participants in their own lives, and that think of their lives as interconnected. And I don't think that just being in communication is the same thing. Mm-hmm. I think it's actually, you know, it's material. It's conditioned by our experiences. So I say, this is a convoluted way, I guess, of saying that I sort of think that the best that we can ever do is, you know, it's conditioned by what's actually available to us in the moment. So we have a terribly chaotic left and a terribly sclerotic left. And in both cases, they're very inadequate. But also, like, so too are the material foundations on which they're being built. And I guess what we can really hope for is that, you know, the events that are the real dialectics will shake the foundations of everything we've built so much that it'll all fall apart, but in a way where we can build something better. Maybe the next left will be better than this one.
I'm going to revamp the Draper classic, Two Souls of Socialism, to be on Twitter and off Twitter.
I am not hopeful that the next left will be better than what we currently have.
Bill Bailey belonged to every radical party that ever came to be. Till he finally decided to start his own party so he wouldn't disagree. He got himself an office with a sign outside the door with Marxist League in letters red. And to everyone who came around, these were the words he said. Oh, you may be a friend of Max Shackman, Jim Cannon, and you may agree. You may get along with Norman Thomas and with Algernon Lee. You may be an old-time wobbly and think J. Love Zone's fine. Yes, you may be a comrade to all of those folks, but you ain't no comrade of mine. For 17 years, Bill Bailey kept his office with the sign outside the door. But he never, ever got a new member. Everybody made him sore. And then one night there came a big fire, and through the flame and smoke, as the firemen rushed in to save Bill's life, these were the words he spoke. Oh, you may be a friend of Ben Giflau, Reverend Musty, and you may agree. May get along with Emma Goldman and with the SLP. You may have belonged to every radical party that ever had a line. Yes, you may be a comrade to all of those folks, but you ain't no comrade of mine. And so on that day, Bill Bailey passed away, and his soul to red heaven flew. He was met at the gate by old Karl Marx and Frederick Engels, too. They said, welcome, comrade, as they opened the door to let Bill come inside. As he slammed the gate back in old Carl's face, these were the words he cried. Oh, you may be a friend of Karl Kautsky and a pal of Bird LaSalle. You may get along with Wilhelm Liebknecht and the First International. Yes, you may have inspired every radical party from the Hudson to the Rhine. Oh, you may be a comrade to all of those folks, but you ain't no comrade of mine.